NMC. That's all I can see.
Thanks very much. I've always been a bit confused about what this populism actually consists of. And I did my way today to look up some kind of definition of it. And apparently it means a political approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups. Well, that sounds very much like ordinary capitalism to me. There's people who think that, you know, as members of the working class, their views and their interests have been disregarded by an established elite group. I mean, absolutely right. It's called the international bourgeoisie, international capitalist class. They exist today just as they've always existed, as we know, of course. But the idea that this elite has suddenly come into power in recent times and this populism has just come from nowhere, it seems to me as complete nonsense. I mean, I agree with Howard, who said earlier on there that there isn't a lot to it. And there isn't a lot to it. What is it really? It's a conspiracy theory. You say to someone who says, yeah, oh, yes, that's right, it's the elite, groups. And you say to them, who are these elite groups? Who are these people? They wouldn't be able to answer you. They haven't a clue. Because there's no elite group apart from the capitalist class itself. The whole idea of there being an elite group, as I say, is a conspiracy theory, but it's not even a very good conspiracy theory. There's nothing to it as a conspiracy theory, even. I mean, at least the assassination of JFK is a conspiracy theory. Actually has some meat to it. Because as we all know, it was the CIA that murdered JFK. But then again, it was the FBI. And again, it was the Castro in Cuba. But then, of course, it was Khrushchev in Russia. But then it was the mafia. And so on. At least there's some kind of meat to the whole story. But there's absolutely nothing to this so-called populism today. And as I say, I still haven't really heard any definition or explanation of just what it's supposed to be, apart from a conspiracy theory. The people who are probably call themselves populists, and the people described as populists by geniuses like Francis Fukuyama, who's big on this. These are the people who say, you know, it's a, oh, we're opposed to the elites. And how do they oppose the elites? Well, they vote for people who are, as we know, completely anti-elitist. People like Nigel Farage. He's an anti-elitist, multi-millionaire stockbroker. And, of course, the less said about Donald Trump, the better. It was mentioned earlier there. You know, not only is Donald Trump the biggest liar and the biggest crook ever to occupy any political office in any country at any time in history, but he's a member of the elite and has been a member of the elite for all of his miserable life. This is a man who's inherited over $400 million. The fact that he lost it all, of course, by owning a casino, which is a minor miracle in itself. Of course, he even lies about that. He says one time that he only ever received from his father a small loan of $1 million. This is the anti-elitist. You can say that, you know, how dare you say I received $400 million. I only really received $1 million. What kind of an anti-elitist is it that considers $1 million to be a small amount of money? But to give Trump his due, I mean, he did tell everybody exactly what he was about. You know, at his rallies, he used to stand at his rallies, and for all intents and purposes, he used to say to people, you know, you should vote for me because you're all poor and losers, and I'm really, really rich. So you should vote for me. And of course, sadly, they did. But just to show how, you know, truthful and honest they are, these populist people like Bannon and that other Furman. most of whom are in jail, of course, or indicted by now. And of course, when Trump gets kicked out, hopefully in a couple of weeks' time, not that it's going to make much difference to the American working class, of course, but you know, it'd be just good to see him getting kicked out. At least there's some kind of general intelligence in America if it happens. But you know, the fact is, these populists supported Trump, even though Trump didn't even win the popular vote. Trump didn't win the vote. Trump, in fact, got less votes than Hillary Clinton by about 3 million. Now, this is the populist who supported system, which is, to all intents and purposes, a two-horse race in which the horse that comes second wins. You know, when all said and done, I mean, what is it that, what is the political system in the situation in America today? It's exactly the same as it's always been. The novelist Gore Vidal was always in the habit of saying that there is no political parties in America, in a sense that there have always been populist parties, if you wanted to find that term somewhere. Gore Vidal says that there's only the property party in America, but it has two wings. And of course, that's the same in every country throughout the world today. You know, capitalism has got its tentacles in every country. And it's exactly the same thing. Either vote for Tweedledee, he stands unequivocally for the capitalist economic system, the very thing that creates all the problems that this so-called populism is supposedly opposed to in the first place. Or you can vote for Tweedledum, he stands unequivocally for the capitalist system, the very thing that creates all the problems that, et cetera, et cetera. I suppose the one thing that we need to be concerned about here in terms of this populism, I think it will die out in a relatively short period of time, especially as Trumpism will certainly die out, and the Socialist Party will certainly be here a long time after it has died out. But just if I just could finish on this point, I'm sorry for taking so long. If I just finish on this point, you know, one of the most depressing things about this whole situation is not only that Trump was able to stand up and say to his listeners, vote for me because you're all idiots and I'm rich. Not only is that depressing, but one of the things I noticed a lot in, you know, when these people are, you know, right, supporting Trump and so on and so forth, I actually seen someone with a placard once with a MAGA hat on, I think it was. And he had some kind of, some T-shirt from, sorry, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Hello? Yeah, we can still hear you. We can still hear you.
Yeah, it's too funny, though.
What is?
No, it's very good. Sorry. Yeah.
Right, well, listen, I'll just finish by this. I got a message there. I suspect that on Buick, it's just message to be there saying, you've been speaking too long, shut up. And this is the worst about this this thing where you can't hear people, see people and so on, so you tend to rub it on a bit. But just let me say this last thing. You know, one of the in terms of these MAGA supporters and these Trump supporters, as I say, I seen one of them with a placard that says something like, you know, these are the people who like, you know, you think the funniest joke in the world was told by Ronald Reagan when he said, you know, what's the scariest phrase you'll ever hear? It's, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And, you know, this was like hilarious to these people. And, you know, these are the people who are out on the streets of America in their protests and so on, their support for this MAGA and so on, with placards that says on it, you know, keep your damn government hands off my Medicaid. Keep your damn government hands off my Medicare. You know, it's the equivalent of people being out in the street in the UK with placards saying, you know, keep your damn government hands off my National Health Service treatment. Keep your damn government hands off my dole money and so on. You know, these people are idiots that supported Trump. Trump's a moron himself, of course. But anyway, that'll do for me. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Can I ask what your name is rather than...
Yeah, my Nigel McCulloch.
It's Nigel. Okay, thank you, Nigel. Okay.
I'm not sure I'd agree that populism is a conspiracy theory or is about conspiracy theories, really. Okay.
Does anyone want to come back on that, on Nigel's comments?
ALB is typing, it says here. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, there he is, Adam.
What Nigel has done, he's given a trailer for next Friday's event, which is our election, US election special, when I'm sure we can be able to discuss Trump and Trumpism and all that on that occasion. But while I've got the floor, I've been thinking what would be a definition of left-wing populism. I think it could be a popular movement which doesn't claim to be so, in inverted commas, of course.
Sorry. Part of what you said then disappeared. Can you say it again?
Yeah, I think a definition of left-wing populism would be a movement, you know, popular movement, which doesn't claim to be socialist, so that, you know, Syriza, Podemos and Bernie Sanders, I mean, they don't go in for all this, you know, rabid nationalism and xenophobia. So, I mean, I think that excludes them from being populist. But some of the things that have been mentioned, the people have been mentioned in Latin America, they've had popular support. They've got support in trade unions and so on. But they don't claim to be socialist. They claim to be, well, nationalist. I think that's the distinction between, you feel like you're common or garden reformist and a left-wing populist.
Thanks, Adam.
Can I just read something I've written? This is, said I drafted a review of this Jorge Tamames book on left-wing populism. Can I just read out a paragraph from it? This is, I haven't sent this in yet, so I, unfortunately, it's not entirely clear what Tamames means by populist. He claims to follow the view of Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe, according to which it involves people going beyond addressing individual problems such as racism, unemployment and evictions, and joining together as a movement. In Tamames' words, quote, "The result is a community mobilising to protest against an entire status quo, not merely asking for a few policy tweaks," end of quote. But it is not spelled out just how this is supposed to apply to the movements he discusses or how it relates to the features usually claimed to distinguish populism, the distinction drawn between the elite and the people, and the opposition to pluralism and separation of powers. So this book, which is supposedly about all about left populism, I don't think he makes much of a claim at all to that particular Podemos and Sanders have anything to do with populism in the normal sense.
Okay, thanks for that. Would anyone else like to come in here? Oh, Nigel.
Can I just make a quick point, actually? And I do apologize, but it just occurred to me there. I'll say it very quickly. Actually, it just shows you how very little changes. I was reading a book recently about Karl Marx, and actually, I forget what you call it. It's called Marx and Jenny and Capital or something like that. It was more about Marx's personal life, but there was a funny anecdote in it where Marx apparently was in the Isle of Man on a trip there, and apparently there was an election going on, and as he and his wife were out for a walk and they turned the corner, apparently they were faced with a massive poster that said simply, "Vote for Williams in this election, a rich man," and that was it. Obviously very little changes, certainly not with Trump in America. Thank you.
I guess we haven't really heard much about how best to argue with a supporter of populist views. We heard from Mike. Steve?
Yeah, I'd just like to ask this Paul for his view on what was suggested earlier on by Nick, we've got the Tories now because a lot of the working class vote. Can you just clarify the party's case as far as the class issue?
I only heard bits of that because bits were obscured.
Yeah. cutting out.
Were you asking me to explain the party position on class?
Yeah, because what one of the previous questions was about why did the working class vote for the Tories? Yeah, there's some sort of misunderstanding about what we consider to be the working class. Could you just clarify that, please?
Yeah. Okay. As far as we're concerned, there are only two classes under capitalism: the capitalist class and the working class. And the working class have to sell their abilities to work for a wage or a salary. And it really doesn't make any difference whether that is done, whether workers work in a factory with their hands or they work in an office and use their brains or whatever. All wage and salary workers are working class. So although there may traditionally have been a distinction made that the working class voted Labour and the middle class voted Tory, that's misleading, since the vast majority, maybe almost everybody who's described as middle class, is actually a member of the working class, because they have to work in order to survive, whereas the capitalist class live very well off rent, interest and profit. So those are the two classes. The 1% or the far less than 1% of the capitalist class, and the 99% of everybody else. And unfortunately, when populists talk about the elite and the people, they don't see it in the way we do. It's all described much more vaguely and much more in, if you like, sociocultural terms rather than in basically economic terms. So is that good enough for you, Steve?
Absolutely, thank you.
Paddy.
Well, just coming back on the question of, you know, how you answer the populists. I mean, something that puzzles me a little bit about the populist view, you know, as Paul described it, is it's a very binary view. You know, it's like it's very us and them. It doesn't really matter how you define who us is or who them is, you know, because I think, as we've seen before, us and them can be practically whoever you want it to be if you're a populist. But surely that ought to be our way in, because in a sense we also take a binary view of society, as we've just had explained. You know, our view of class is basically a binary view. You're either in the working class, in which case you've got a common interest and you're the part of the 99%, or you're a capitalist, in which case you're part of the 1%, and you're you know, essentially the class enemy. Well, you know, I don't really see why it ought to be so difficult for us to then game the populist argument. You know, sort of say, okay, I see where you're coming from. You're talking about the vast group of what you want to call normal people, and then you've got this other kind of elite group of what you want to call not normal people. We can go along with that. It's just that you haven't quite defined them right. We think that normal people are this, and then we explain what we think the working class is, and we think that your elite is that, and then we explain what a capitalist class is. Do you see what I mean? I don't see why it shouldn't be that difficult. But then that's me just being optimistic.
I think using words like normal and non-normal is probably not a good idea. And the sort of language that populists use is things like common people, ordinary people, or something like that. I did say towards the end that the one way to begin arguing with a populist supporter is to ask them about who they think the elite and the people are, and then take it from there. The trouble is, I think you would get an answer which was terribly vague, and which, when you ask people to be a bit more specific, they probably wouldn't be able to. But I would agree that that would be a way in to get them to try to be more specific, and then give our view instead, and no doubt convince them straight away. Who's that laughing?
Oh, have I left my right before, Bob? Sorry.
Snigger in private, please.
Yeah, exactly, Steve.
Right.
Okay, I'd like to come in here, Paul. The thing is, I mean, we call people stupid, but really, it's like people who own their own house or who have a property that they rent out, basically, they consider themselves capitalists. So there's this whole confusion about who's a member of the working class and who's a capitalist, because they see capitalists as owning things. And we are basically indoctrinated to think that we must own our house and we've got a car and we've got property that we can rent out. So that kind of makes people think they've got a whole stake in this capitalist system, that they have a stake, when really they don't. So I think the way basically is to kind of say, well, to ask them what kind of stake you have in this society. What do you own? What would happen if, they didn't pay your rent or blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, what can, but people, lots of workers do identify with the capitalist class.
Oh, hold on. I must say, I've never heard anybody say, I own my own house, therefore I'm a capitalist.
Oh, God, I have.
Have you really? Oh,
yes.
God.
Yes, they think they're capitalists. It's laughable.
Hmm. Of course, you live in London, don't you? So I suppose that's a bit different. But more generally, yes, many workers do identify with, or how you want to say it, the capitalist class, or see or think that the capitalists are needed to create jobs and so on, and have all these brilliant ideas like Amazon and so on. Yeah. I don't see we can do anything much more than just plug away and say, no, the capitalist class are this very tiny minority who, in a sense, they're so far removed from you and me that we don't really... I'm going to say we don't identify them. That's not what I mean. We don't really see them as part of the situation at all. So it's not like when there was the mill owner who lived in the big house and so on. It's, you know... The Trumps and the Bransons and so on, they're just completely separate, and it's very hard to say that they're the enemy when you can't really see who they are, as it were. Yeah, sorry, that wasn't very coherent, I think.
Yeah.
And just say a few words without Davis and about with us speaking to you again, if you
don't mind. Come on then, Paul.
Sorry.
Come on then.
Sorry, I thought you said hang on then.
No,
Paul.
No,
sorry,
no, 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 sorry. Sorry, Paul. Yeah, go ahead.
Go on. I think sometimes you have to be cruel to be kind, you know, and when workers do hit you with and add a bit of a debate, a Telegraph reader online a few weeks ago who was just... really, all over the shop, you know, because he was a boss in the, or seen himself as a boss in the NHS, and, you know, he was middle class or possibly even upper class. I think sometimes you have to be a little bit cruel and actually remind them that maybe they're suffering from a grandiose case of delusions of grandeur. Try and maybe emphasise that it takes a very special to think like socialists do, and I think we are very special that we have got the capacity to think outside the box and what lies ahead, and just keep promoting that idea in as positive a way as possible. I think Paddy's got a fairly positive spin on it, and I'm sure we all have, rather than be defeatist and impossibilists, we ought to retain that sense of optimism without tripping ourselves up and, painting this illusion of someone help me out here, when was it? Utopian, it's described as being utopian. and say, you know, and accept that there will be problems ahead. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be a hell of a lot better without the impediment of cash and money and all that kind of stuff. But certainly delusions of grandeur, I think, is the one that usually gets most workers thinking, saying to themselves, maybe in their own mind, their own subconscious, Christ, maybe he's got an eye, maybe this person I'm speaking with is not too wrong, maybe he has got a point, maybe this is how it is, I'm mortgaged up to my eyeballs, you know, I lose my job, I potentially lose my house, and, you know, it's maybe not all that I think it's cracked up to be. And I, for one, think that that's one way of dealing with it. If you're starting to maybe lose the argument or the debate, it's just hitting with that delusions of grandeur. And hopefully we'll give them some food for thought. Cheers. Thanks for letting me in there, Carla.
No problem. Adam? Adam?
Yeah, I thought that somebody else was before me disappeared. On this question of how you would argue with a populist, I think the first thing that would come up would be nationalism. I mean, the only populists I think I've argued with would be people that were going to vote Leave in the EU referendum. And then a few years ago, there was a by-election in Rochester, I think. The MP had gone over to the Tory MP had gone over to UKIP and he resigned and stood again. And the place was full of UKIP supporters. But I mean, as I say, I think the first thing that's going to come up is nationalism. You know, UKIP, UK Independence Party, and vote Leave, you know, get out of Europe. I don't think it'll be a question of you know, who the elite are. It's what is nationalism? What is a nation?
Then?
Yeah,
then,
sorry.
I just
found the unmute button. No, I was following on with the speaker before Adam, is that, yes, I mean, property owning, especially, say, down in London, you know, like, property is so expensive. If you've got a mortgage, it's like you've been got two ways. They're sort of like the Tories in the late 70s, early 80s were trying to get people to own property. But it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you can say, oh, I'm a part of capitalism. But on the other hand, you know, you're three or four wage packages away from being homeless. So, you know, it's a sort of like a scary thing. And it's people in peril that turn to populism. But unfortunately, the thing that I find it hard to get through to populists is that they're so engaged with the fetishism of leadership. You know, there's always going to be some charismatic beggar up there that they're willing to follow. And, you know, like socialism is not a philosophy that deals with you know, leadership in that way, and that's a hard thing. I think the hardest thing to get across is, you know, you've got to get rid of this idea of, you know, like the big bosses and the big leaders. It's something you've got to, you know, the working class has to break their own chains.
Thanks, Lynn. Steve?
Yeah, I was just going to echo the first thing that the first thing that Vin said, so I'll echo it now. In the last 6 months, we've seen how these wonderful free human beings that we all are in this country are just 4 or 5 weeks away from utter destitution. I mean, if the government weren't behaving in an anti-capitalist manner as it is at the moment, what would the unemployment rate have been now? What would people be living on? It's just and it's this sort of fantasy world that some people living in that they seem to deny the possibility that they're going to end up in that sort of destitution. And not only in a case like we've got with COVID, not only on an individual basis, but regularly, that the capitalist system keeps grinding to a halt on a regular basis. And then, of course, this is absolutely where these populists come in and say, oh, look, it was the banker's fault, or look, it was the politician's fault. So I mean, basically, we've just got to keep pushing the case, keep pushing the idea of the the capitalist system itself is the cause of all these problems. What you raised, Carl, is a serious barrier. People think that they've got a stake. Whereas that, in actual fact, when you look at a house, it's not social wealth at all. One of the arguments you can come these days is, there's probably some younger people on listening now that don't know about what happened in the 1980s with sell-off of councillors and stuff like that, and the Tory argument that we're going to create a property-only democracy. All of these houses that are being sold off, you know, all of the British gas shares and British Rail being denationalised and so on and so forth. But these people that have got such a stake now in capitalist society because they own a house, just get dementia, just need social care in the last 10 years of your life, and suddenly all of this wealth that you've got or you thought you had disappears, and basically there'll be nothing left at the end of your life. You'll just be in exactly the same penury as if you never bought that house. That's all. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Well, on that cheerful note, thank you.
I'd just like to come in.
No, it's okay.
Okay, anyone else got a question or comment? Nigel?
Could I just follow up very quickly on what the last speaker said there? Yeah, it's very interesting that, of course, what the present situation with the pandemic and so on has shown is that most workers, although they think they're doing well by owning their own house and others having their own mortgage and so on, they're literally about 4 or 5 weeks away from being kicked out on the street. That's the economic aspect of it. But I think one of the things that is a bit of an eye-opener too, I think, is the political situation. So when you look at what's happened in America, to hark back on that a wee bit, it's just as well, really, that Trump is a moron. Because if Trump had kept people like Bannon and so on around him and they didn't sort of reveal themselves for the criminals they are and get arrested and so on, and people like Manafort and so on, I mean, does anyone doubt that Trump could have set up a dictatorship in America? The way he got himself a lapdog of an attorney general and so on, the way he has basically emasculated all of the aspects of the Constitution that were supposed to stop a dictator coming to power in America and so on. Does anybody really doubt that the bourgeois democratic state in America is one step away from being a dictatorship? If someone like Trump came along in the future who wasn't an utter moron like him, I certainly could see it happening easy enough. Thanks.
Carl, oh, sorry. I was muted myself. Ridiculous. Just to say, Nicola's a message. Just a thanks for the interesting talk. And she says, can't speak. Sorry. Now, I don't know whether that's a technical issue or something else. Anyway, Richard Botterill.
I'm just going to cheer everyone up with my view. And there's quite a number of people who know more about this than me who think that it's possible that Donald Trump could become a dictator. They're not quite sure what to do. I think in terms of the courts and the Constitution, everything, if Trump was to say, look, all these postal ballots, I just don't accept them. It's a fix. This election is null and void. And he could just stay. He could probably try and just stay in the White House and you'd see what happens next. So I wish I hadn't said that now. I'll give everyone nightmares. But actually, we shouldn't get into this personal thing. In a way, our view is really it doesn't matter who's in charge, who is nominally head of state in capitalist countries, because whoever's in power it's the capitalist class that are in power. And we have to accept that, you know, there's that democracy in capitalism is a very limited thing. Even Margaret Thatcher said, you can have, this was her view, she said, you can have capitalism without democracy, but you can't have democracy without capitalism. And that's just making me think about this, you know, this whole myth of the property-owning democracy, which, you know, in the Thatcher era, I thought this is going to be wonderful. All these people, they mortgage themselves up to the hilt. Then a recession comes. Interest rates go up. Thousands upon thousands of repossessions. Sorry, I'm just making points that other people have made. But, you know, I just wanted to really say that within capitalism, democracy is a very fragile thing. And often people who get elected become dictators or emperors, like Napoleon III, for instance. The Nazis were sort of elected, and they're also quite popular. Hitler was very popular at one time, as far as we can make out. And we just have to keep giving people our message, trying to put our case across as best we can. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Richard. Howard?
Richard, if you don't mind me saying, you're being ahistorical. You can't quote Napoleon III or Hitler as examples of fragile democracies becoming dictatorships. They happened a long time ago. Capitalism has developed, and its democracies are still fragile, admittedly, but they're less fragile in some places than in others. No chance at all what you suggest will take place in the United States, whatever the outcome of the election.
Is that what's going to be discussed next Friday? Is that right?
Don't know. Paddy can come in on that.
Could be. I should save my comment for next week then. But actually, no, I won't. I'm to agree with Howard, really. I remember that lots of us can remember back in the dark days of Thatcher when across the pond we had the monstrosity of Reagan, you know, the sort of failed B-movie actor who became president. Oh, my God, only in America could it happen. And, you know, we all thought, oh, that's it, it's going to be nuclear war or something. This is a guy who joked about nuking Cuba while he was still president-elect and caused an international incident. You know, he thought that was funny. He was Trump, but actually quite a lot more genial and affable than Trump. Trump is just a nasty piece of work, full stop. But Trump isn't any more intelligent than Reagan. But the point about that I'm making about Reagan is people thought the world was going to come to an end when Reagan got into power. But I can't remember who it was that did the biography of the Reagan years, but basically what they said was anyone who worried about Reagan pushing the button didn't need to, because he didn't have a button. When it came to sensitive papers that he could sign, they basically didn't go across his desk in the first place because his White House staff made sure of it. And only about a year ago or 2 years ago, someone can tell, could probably give you the name, but there was a sort of unofficial biog of Trump, which said exactly the same thing. It's like, if there's anything really sensitive that we think that he can't deal with, it doesn't go across his desk. Basically, Trump doesn't get told what he doesn't need to know. And this is the thing with these knobheads who are in power in not just in America, but in everywhere. They're in power as long as they're useful, but they're not really the people who hold the power.
Absolutely.
Those are the big companies. Those are the ruling class. So let's not get too hypnotized by the democratic circus here. Even if Trump gets in for another 4 years, he's not going to do any huge damage to capitalism because he won't be allowed to, the same as Reagan wasn't allowed to, and the same as Obama wasn't really allowed to either. And that's another thing, you know, they don't have to be just nutters. They can be people who, you know, I think Obama was quite sincere in his own way, some of the things he wanted to do. You know, you could see him, his feelings about gun control, I think, were quite sincere, but he couldn't do shit. Right, because he couldn't, and that's supposedly the most powerful man in the world, and he couldn't do shit about gun control. So I don't think we want to get too carried away about the idea about Trump being some sort of fascist dictator in the making. What a load of balls. No chance.
Okay, thank you. Mike Brown?
Yeah, I'll just say one word about Paddy. Putin. He's not an idiot, but he has power.
Paddy, you want to come back on that?
Well, Putin is facing increasing amounts of opposition in the eastern part of Russia. He's been called in. Well, he's been asked to come and go and help his mate, the arch Stalinist strongman, Lukashenko, in Belarus. Because he's in trouble. You know, these are people who just make people disappear who oppose them. This isn't America. You know, I was talking about America. I wasn't talking about Russia. But even in Russia, even in Belarus, where the police will quite happily kick the shit out of people and kill them if they oppose the government, even there, they're being opposed. Recently, I don't know how many people sort of followed what happened in Sudan a year just to sort of, or so ago. Again, that was a military dictatorship that would basically machine gun you if you went out and protested. And yet people still went out and protested, and they videoed it. They videoed what happened, and they sent it around the news media of the world. And so that it was in the public eye, and the government eventually had to back down and is now involved in a power sharing agreement with the sort of capitalist democratic opposition. So, you know, I'm not saying that this is revolutionary, but there's a limit to what they can get away with when the eyes of the world are upon them. And I think the thing about one thing I think that we underestimate about capitalist democracy, it's yes, it's shit. Yes, it's used to elect the same bunch of, you know, pigs with their snouts in the trough time after time. But that's only because workers choose to let those people be elected. But the machinery of democracy is really powerful, potentially. And that's why, you know, that's what we say in the party. The machinery of democracy is incredibly powerful if workers want to use it. And I don't think we should ever underestimate the power of that democracy, its potential. And talk, you know, sort of loose talk about so-and-so becoming a dictatorship here or there. You know, liberal capitalist, you know, state. Well, I think that's what it is. I think it's loose talk. I don't think you can really run the clock backwards. In places like China and North Korea, they haven't had democracy in the first place. It's a bit of a different case. But in somewhere like America, you know, as president that tried to be a dictator, I think he'd be assassinated in a fortnight.
Okay, Paddy, I want to interject here, Obama. About his sincerity, really? I mean, you know, he was interested in, you know, gun law things, but yet every Tuesday he'd have a hit list, you know, and he would drone bomb weddings and funerals. I mean, sorry, I can't kind of get my head around that one. Sincerity. It's a bloody hypocrite.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? I mean, yeah, you've got overseas wars, you know. Violence.
Okay, Nigel.
Yeah, just again, very quickly. I was interested to listen to Paddy give that prognosis there. I must say I don't agree with it, though. I mean, I certainly agree that the machinery of the democratic capitalist state is pretty powerful, and that's why workers can use it for in the process of the socialist revolution and for emancipation. But it works the other way, of course. It means that somebody else gets the hold of it. And I mean, I accept, of course, that what we're talking about here is, I mentioned earlier on about Gore Vidal saying that there's only one party in America, the property party. Of course, the two parties are just the mouthpieces of the capitalist class in America and so on. No matter what happens, it'll be the capitalist class in power. But of course, you can have capitalism as a democratic state, and you can have capitalism as a fascist state, as was pointed out. I would say the only thing that's saving America from becoming a dictatorship is the fact that Trump is a moron. I suspect if Trump had any real brains at all, he would have kept all those people that I mentioned earlier on around him. He's got a lapdog for an attorney general. He's put someone on the Supreme Court today to give a majority for the what they call conservatives and so on. A woman who's an utter Catholic bigot, as opposed to any kind of rights for anybody in America, as far as I can see, apart from the Roman Catholic Church. And she's now going to be on the Supreme Court. They rammed that through in 4 weeks, practically. Having said previously with Obama that he couldn't nominate someone for the Supreme Court because there's only 9 months to go to the election. They've rammed that through, sorry, not 4 weeks, about 9 weeks. It just shows you what they can do when they want to. And as the mouthpieces of the capitalist class, if it was in the interest of the capitalist class to have Trump as a dictator, you'd bet your life they'd do it. Fortunately, he's too stupid. But, you know, think about it. That person who he put on the Supreme Court today, she was asked by Kamala Harris, does she think that Trump could stay in office and refuse to leave if he thought that there was an anomaly of some sort with the election? And she says she refused to answer. She refused to answer a question if the American people vote Trump out, you think he should leave? She says she wouldn't answer the question. That's how fragile it is in America. You know, it's not too far-fetched. Jack London, of course, used to read a lot of stuff about an American dictatorship. It was quite interesting. Anyway, thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Nigel. Okay. Anyone else? Okay, do we want to finish up, Paul? Oh, Adam's
ALB
typing.
ALB is typing.
Yeah, Adam's typing.
Let's see if he has anything interesting to say, shall we? No, it's not to us, is it?
I don't think so. I think he's writing to someone else, but...
In that case, no. Some of the discussion got a bit off the point, I think. But it was.
I think it did, but...
Some of the questions were interesting and about left-wing populism and Latin America and so on and so on, yeah.
Wait a minute, Steve is typing.
Applying to Adam.
Yeah. All I was going to say is, yes, it is time to finish them. So I second that motion.
Okay. Thanks. Steve?
Thanks, Paul. Thanks very much.
Just very quickly, we've had a discussion tonight about some of the fine points of what's going on in capitalism. And there is obviously certain amount of disagreement amongst the party members about that. But what we're all absolutely in favour of is the idea that whichever clown gets voted in in America, whichever clown is in charge in Hungary, they're not or in this country, that they're not going to be able to control capitalism. And that is the big con that's always been played on the working class. And one of the horrible things about populism, we'll go back to that, the horrible thing about populism is that it does exploit and reinforce nationalism, patriotism, racism, xenophobia, call it what you will, and it acts as a barrier to socialism. But this has come about not just through right-wing parties, but also by these so-called social democrat parties. Because every time that these scabs
have been confronted with the capitalist class wanting a war. They've always gone along with it, and they've always supported patriotism, they've always supported nationalism, and they're an absolute disgrace to, and they will always be fed. I've just got upset. Sorry about that.
Thanks for that final comment, Steve. Thank you. And thank you, Paul, for a great talk.
Okay.
On Cheers. Behalf of everyone here, thank you very much, and good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Dan. Thank you.